My name is Elmer Witt. This is a session on, good grief, what is it now? Where's all the startle gone? On Monday, July 2nd.
Third.
Well, the fourth better be tomorrow, right? Okay. Let's begin with a prayer. I'm still coming down from the worship last night, so the prayer will reflect a little of that. Gracious God, teach us to recognize an alabaster jar when we have one and what to do with it. For Jesus' sake, amen. As you gathered, I'm interested in talking about a startle, and it probably started with me, well, I don't know where it started, but I used this story. A priest friend of mine, Jesuit Father Pat Carroll, whom I've been trying to get to come here for years, but hasn't been able to make it, in a conversation said to me once, you'll get in trouble in the Roman Catholic Church if you monkey around too much with the liturgy. And he says, you will get in trouble in the Roman Catholic Church, especially if you're a priest and you get too close to somebody of the opposite sex. But you will never get in trouble in the Roman Catholic Church if you are boring. And my response to that was, which of the three is the greatest sin? I dare say, to be boring about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Not trying to condone other sins, but it's the greatest by far. The greatest by far. I hang with the Gospels because I was in youth ministry for 14 years. Learned from some German colleagues that the way to go with kids is the story, the gospel story. Work with stories, work with the gospel stories. And I still believe that, since I think all of us are still kids. In my confirmation class, the first one I had in a little parish in Barstow, California, of the three kids that were, four kids that were confirmed, two of the girls were pregnant before they were juniors in high school, and one of the boys was picked up on a federal rap at age 18. So then I started to go into youth ministry because I could only go up from there. But what we did then, as I revamped what I obviously had done before, is we spent almost all of our time talking about the story of Jesus Christ, so that before we went into the teachings of the church, they were able to tell their own story of our Lord's life, so that the drawing on the gospel would be the thing that would nourish them and put into context the teachings of the church. In contrast to when I was confirmed, when we spent 4.5 months on the Ten Commandments and 2.5 hours on the Eucharist and all the rest of the stuff. So I come from that background. I don't know, maybe you do, what the opposite of startle is. Do you have an antonym for startle? What would it be?
Or predictable.
Mm-hmm. The dictionary I checked this morning has no antonyms. So, shock is a synonym. So maybe bland, and non-shock is maybe what it is. Or boring.
Routine.
Average. Whatever. Yeah.
Think of a slug.
A slug. All right. And yes, I would continue to maintain it's the being a slug with the gospel of Jesus Christ is worse than lots of others. To let them go, we always know the answer. We've heard the stories before. We know how the story's going to turn out, and there isn't any push to it, any bounce to it, any excitement to it. Back in my Missouri Synod days, the line in the, well, it's used in some of our liturgies yet, the liturgy said is we worship the God who has given power to become, given us power to become the children of God. Greatest line in the liturgy, I thought. And then what you wanted to do is watch what people were doing when they heard that said. You know, some were yawning, somebody scratching himself, you know, and whatever. But where is all the startle gone, you know? Because we've heard it before and before. And so we search. Easy to preach. As long as you ask me to preach about all of our sins, because I know a lot about those. But if it's supposed to be the gospel alive, that's tough business. A good preacher spends most of his time on crafting the way the gospel is going to, if you will, erupt into the service. And I believe in signs and wonders. That's the only thing. Last night we didn't even speak about dreams, did we? To my knowledge, in the LBW, there's only one line in the liturgy about dreams. The Bible's filled with dreams, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of dreams, yeah. Lutherans have got one line about dreams. Gather the hopes and the dreams of all. And again, one of the best lines, I think, in the liturgy. It's a gorgeous thing. But one of the dreams that I have about all this is that we should be able to work hard at letting these things happen and erupt. So at 4:30 this morning, I made up a story. Miriam is up early, around 4:30 also, and running around her three-room Jerusalem place. And her husband, Joash, is bothered by her bustling about, and for crying out loud. See, this was a prime time story, so you can't use other words than that. For crying out loud, what are you doing running around this early in the morning? I can't get any sleep. And Miriam says, well, if you wouldn't get drunk every night, you'd be able to get some decent sleep. And besides, there's a new rabbi coming to town. And I hear he's great. He's a, you know, Holy Moses or whatever. That's the 32nd rabbi this week. And now you're going out again this early in the morning? No, this one's different. He hangs around with even people like you. He welcomes everybody. And when he talks, it isn't like other rabbis. And he says, it's hard for me to believe. It's hard for me. Well, and all the women on the street are going. And he said, well, I don't know. Maybe it's a foretaste of the feast to come. And just to let you know, that's where the Holden directors got that theme for the summer, from a drunken Jew in Palestine. The dullness dare not ever be in the gospel. When Nathan says, you're the one, that's not dull. That gets through, usually. If somebody ever corners us and gets through to us with, you're the one, primal confrontation, that's usually not too dull. But it's on the other end of the word about what God has been about, is about, always will be about. When that isn't startling, then we get closer to losing the battle. And so there's all kinds of Bible studies. You know, you can take a chapter, you can take a book. Dan Erlanders takes about three words and works 3 weeks on them and is marvelous at it. I'm just going to lift up about five different ideas during the week, reflect about it, what I'm thinking and saying, and then ask you to participate. And that means you should be free to come in whenever you want. To disagree or say I don't get it or whatever, that's fine. And we'll start by reading the a text from Matthew 25. And as I said, I believe in signs and wonders and dreams. When I came out this morning at 6:35, there was a rainbow up there. So I took it personally. And then when the matins use the same text that I'm using. I took it personally, you know. So we'll look at chapter 25, verses 31 to 46, to the end of the chapter. And would someone read to 237, and then somebody else read the rest of it? Anybody who feels comfortable reading out loud? Good, Barbara.
When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand with the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Do you want me to stop?
Yeah. Wherever you stop, somebody else can pick up. Somebody?
The righteous will then answer him. When, Lord, did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? When did we ever see you a stranger and welcome you in our homes, or naked and clothe you? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you? The king will reply, I tell you, whenever you did this for one of the least important of these brothers of mine, you did it for me.
So, somebody else want to pick it up?
Then he will say to those on his left, Away from me, you that are under God's curse. Away to the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. I was hungry, but you would not feed me. Thirsty, but you would not give me a drink. I was a stranger, but you would not welcome me in your homes. Naked, but you would not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, but you would not take care of me. Then I will answer him, When, Lord, did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison, and we would not help you? The king will reply, I tell you, whenever you refuse to help one of these less important ones, you refuse to help me. These then will be sent off to eternal punishment, but the righteous will go to eternal life.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for reading. Pretty familiar story. You know, I think biblical illiteracy grows by leaps and bounds, and that's why I've chosen some stories that we just get to refresh ourselves about age-old stories. I got more stories than I knew what to do with when I grew up in the Missouri Synod, and I'm grateful for those stories. I learned a lot of them. But less and less people that I know about them. And this is one, though, that's pretty well known. Sheep and goats get across somehow. Sheep and goats ate together, but were separated when they traveled. Sort of interesting that you could be together at the meal, but not when you traveled. It didn't work. And most of us hear this story from the sheep side, you know. We want to be over there pretty easily. It's part of Jesus' last instructions, or at least as Matthew puts it together, for the disciples. He tells a number of stories Matthew puts together to say, this is the way it's going to be, and you've got to deal with this now that I'm shortly going to be gone from you. And he tells a story about the 10 bridesmaids, the ones that were ready and the ones that weren't. And he tells about the people who have different talents, 5 and 3 and 1, what happens with those. And then he tells this story. It's an eschatological story, meaning that we humans live an existence that somehow is going to be measured. And pretty clear that there's expectations for following in the footsteps of Jesus. Pretty clear that it isn't going to be enough to say, well, I believe, that there's more to it than that. It's pretty clear that the story says you ain't going to have a chance forever. And that's pretty potent stuff. Maybe because it is pushy right there, that's why it's remembered. I've preached a good grief. I haven't told this story in ages. My last sermon at a parish I was in, and I left in 1953, the last sermon was entitled, "You Have Been Warned." Good grief. Good grief. Oh, man. It reminded me, there was a sign in St. Louis on a highway, 45 miles an hour, and then a little while later is another one, "You Have Been Warned." I used that idea. But how terrible. One woman took my adult class in Victorville, California, twice and did not join. And she was right. She shouldn't have. I was peddling pretty bad stuff. And I'm glad God's been helpful. I don't think the stuff is that bad anymore. But the law sticks, you know, and people meet me today from that parish. There's only a few left that know me. They remember that sermon. Ah! But here's the story that we mostly know. Where's the gospel in here? Where's the gospel?
But when you do it to one of the least of these, you do it to me.
What's it?
It? Minister, care for, help, respond.
I think maybe it says the unconsciousness of when the believers were doing it, when the sheep were ministering. They didn't know they were doing it, ministering to Christ, but they were ministering to other people.
Neither did the ones who didn't.
Neither did the
It's kind of a conscious inclusion that's forgiveness without judgment.
But it says, you know, you that are accursed, depart from me in eternal life prepared for the devil and his angels.
Oh, you're talking about the people.
The whole story. I'm saying where in the whole story is the gospel? Yeah.
I think it's found in the assumption that deep within us is the gospel, and that if we listen to the gospel, which means responding to the needs of others, that it's the gospel that brings out that sense of compassion within us, and that if we respond to the gospel within us, that we will become people who find the needs in other people and respond to those. Mm.
So it's an assumption, huh?
An assumption.
Okay. Somebody else?
I think it's in the opportunity to respond.
Okay.
When the gospel comes to us, we have the opportunity to respond to that gospel.
I hear that.
And
but you're saying in this story, it's in the opportunity.
It's in the opportunity to change or to respond, and the gospel calls us to change our lives.
Okay.
I think I see it in the surprising and startling places that Jesus is found. That the good news is that Jesus is here, present.
Mm-hmm.
In some pretty startling folk and places.
Mm-hmm.
And Luigi sees it somewhere else.
Oh, excuse me, right here.
I don't see it somewhere else. There must be some waves going.
Yeah, right. Good. Good, I'm glad.
I was thinking that perhaps the good news is that the presence of Christ is for this world, this bodily existence, mm-hmm. and not for some time, mystery time mm-hmm. after death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are all good hints of the gospel. I frankly don't think the gospel's in there. other than the who's telling the story. If you remember, it is Jesus Christ who told the story and is telling the story, then for me it becomes gospel, because in contrast I'd say it comes from outside of me, but we're probably going to talk more about that as we go along. Because I see the gospel as what God is doing and accomplishing inside and outside of us all the time, God's activity in order to make it possible for us to be the kind of people that God is so interested in, which is all of us, and especially in those crazy places that God pops up, which is the startling part of the gospel. Can I tell a story about, when I found out Fred Niedner had been teaching Bible class 2 weeks ago, I got all scared because I use Niedner's stories. And I, here I come and I come and tell stuff he was telling himself. I don't know if he told this or not. In one of his sermons, and I try to get as many of Fred Niedner's sermons as I can, he says to the people, fantasize with me a little bit about this story. He said, you hear the word to the people on the right, and they find out that they're blessed of the Father because they had done these things. And they're startled. What are you talking about? And Jesus explains, the least of these, you've done it to me. And the people on the other side, you know, hear a curse and if we knew it was you, if we knew you were there, we would surely have done it, you know. But then what happens, Niedner says, is there rejoicing in the people on the right because they're getting in? Or is it really that the people on the right are absolutely stunned and cannot respond because of what they heard said to the people on the left? They can't believe that these people have no chance. And they start clawing at the Son of Man and say, we gotta go. We gotta go talk to them. We gotta go be with them. We gotta help them. And the Son of Man says, oh, tough, too late, too late. And then the people on the right say, then you've got to go. That's the gospel. What they did all through their life, they're still doing at the end, wanting them to have the good of the Father. That adds a little startle to the story because you don't know that one, you know. And I like that kind of startle to the story. So that the good news excites us, stirs us up, shocks us, pushes us. One of the definitions I saw this morning, to cause to start involuntarily. My faith needs an awful lot of starting involuntarily that pushes me along. The good news to be heard. I thought we heard it well last night. We're mostly in the motif of forgiveness. I'm going to talk about that. I'm not sure that forgiveness is... Well, I know it's not the only motif in scriptures. I'm not sure it's the easiest or best motif, and I'll get in trouble for that one of the coming days. But we did hear it clearly last night, and I was grateful for that. I attend St. Leo's Parish in Tacoma at least once a month because the priest there is so saturated in the gospel of Jesus Christ. I always hear the gospel at St. Leo's Parish. Now, that's a terrible statement. Maybe I hear it because I'm looking for it. I don't know. But I go looking for it wherever I go. I tell you, that's why I go to worship. I need to hear the gospel and want to hear it. And I'm so grateful for St. Leo's Parish because of that. And I asked the priest one time, how'd you get this way? It sort of oozes out of it, you know? It really does, in fresh ways. And he says, well, when I came here, these people are doing, they're in the hilltop of Tacoma. If anybody knows Tacoma, you know, that's a tough place. That he said they were doing most of the things I thought they should be doing, you know. They had food programs, they got all kinds of social services, and they're committed to helping the people, and there's a mix of people all over the place, in the place, a foretaste of the feast to come. And so I figured it was just my job to tell the story. I said, can you spread the word? It was his job to tell the story, and that's what he does. And it is the story of what God is about. One of my favorite passages in Luke is, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom, old translation. The Greek word allows for, and I think maybe even calls for, your Father has determined to give you the kingdom. Determined. Not casual, could be, maybe, what, no. What God is about is giving, and nothing less than the kingdom. Not just the church, which is not the kingdom. Even though the congregation I grew up in Chicago, the kingdom wasn't the Lutheran church, it was St. John Church. Quite clearly, right here. But all of what God is about in all of creation is what God has given and is determined to give it. Some of you knew my daughter Mary. One of her prayers when she was about this big was, dear God, hold on to us and don't let us get loose. I love it. I love it. God is determined to hold on to us and not let us get loose. Nathan still comes along and says, you're the one. Matthew comes along and tells the story and says, hey, look at these crazy places where my son hangs out. Hungry and prison and thirsty and sick and all that place. And we ought to hear the confrontation of God. There is judgment and there is mercy. But the thing that lasts and surrounds and overwhelms is the mercy, the compassion of God. Is that weird? Well, I had therapy a couple of times. And Jewish therapist, oh my, did I see God at work there. But what he said, as long as you Christians keep preaching, you shall be perfect because I, the Lord your God, am perfect, I shall be in business. And isn't it neat to know that the word has probably been mistranslated. It's very, very, very possible. I believe it is. You shall be compassionate as I, the Lord your God, am compassionate. And if we believe and know and hear and receive and whatever else you or verb you want to use, that God is compassionate, and that what is God all is all about, then we too are called to be compassionate. Because it's possible. The stuff is coming all the time. We celebrated at feasts, like last night. A feast of word, a feast of oboe, a feast of bread and wine, all kinds of feasts that bring the compassionate God and excite us. And once in a while, anyway, startle us, I hope. But maybe you've got some startling reactions to the text. Please.
I was thinking when you were telling us the sermon that you were talking about, it reminded me a lot of C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, mm-hmm. and that sense of the ongoing, all they have to do is get on the bus. You know, all you have to do is turn, mm-hmm. but it's always there, and it's a gift that is constant, and I guess that I would say that it's planted within us. Mm-hmm. That gift is planted within us as we were mm-hmm. created in the image of this God that's mm-hmm. compassionate.
Okay. Okay. Somebody else?
Oh,
yes. Go on.
spending a real little time with homeless in a project of our church and fighting with kind of this particular scripture because they have a way of life and you know you're being conned. And it's a real struggle to want to give, but not always to give. And the night the guy needed $10, so he get to court to defend himself for drugs. And I finally get to the point saying, well, you might as well kiss your, you know, what to buy. I didn't give him $10. But they really, at least I find it, a real struggle within myself in being there with them. You know, they are the least, but yet they've got some terrible routines at their work.
Somebody reaction to that? That you're there and that you're struggling about it? Boy, is that great. That's great. And then, of course, I flip into saying how many times I con my Lord. $10 here, $10 there. The least of these, my brethren, to... Yeah, it's tough. And I think that's the compassionate God who knows us and our con jobs from A to Z and keeps coming back. When I was in campus ministry at Governor State University in Chicago, the thing that griped the daylights of the people who didn't come to anything related to religion was that you could always come back. You know, I'm baptized. I come back again and again and again. And they, well, I told a story in the earlier session. Last summer, coming back, my wife and I were in Spain, we went over to Morocco, and coming back, Jewish friend I found on the, that we met on the tour, I was talking to him about saints and sinners, about how we are saints and we are sinners at the same time. And that we don't, it isn't on and off. Tuesday I'll be a saint, Wednesday sinner, you know, all this. But at the very moment we are most saintly, we are still sinners. And at the very moment we are most sinners, we are Indian saints. And he said, nope. I don't believe it. It's too easy. I said, Steve, you understand it. If you think it's too easy, you understand it. Because the gospel, you know, if the gospel isn't, here, can I get in trouble? Good. If the gospel isn't almost libertarian, it's probably not the gospel. It's borderline libertarian. Because it's that weird. It's weird. It's crazy. That God would want to constantly give us back, or if you want, say God plant into us, whatever it may be. That's not normal. We want to react on, you know, don't con me, baby. That's the way I do it. I know. I don't like to be taken.
I like to respond to
sure.
A homeless situation. I think it's easy to give somebody $10. It's more difficult to. Be there with them, go to the court, or sleep on the street with them, or eat a meal with them. That's the more difficult mm-hmm. thing. Okay. And it's kind of like a test. What I feel about is that, you know, what's the limit here? What can I, you know, if you give them $10, they say, well, the next time they're going to ask you for $20. Mm-hmm. it's just tell me what, you know, where your limits are. So I don't think giving them the money necessarily is. The right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's also not the difficult thing to do. And the gospel followed it. You know, the story about the people who were the sheep, they didn't even know what they were doing that they were with those people.
Yeah.
And they were having fun doing it too. You know, if it's something that's a burden to be with the sinners, so, yeah, Jesus probably had fun with the sinners too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that there needs to be some joy there as well. Mm-hmm.
Good. Somebody else? Yeah.
Once I were coming home from here, I'd come out from the Midwest on a bus. And going home, we stopped in, somewhere in Idaho for a rest stop, going to a restaurant. And there was a girl in there who had a tiny baby, and she was so short of funds that she didn't have enough food to feed the baby. And she was asking people to help her, but at the same time, she was smoking cigarettes in that baby's face. And I didn't know what to do. And she got money, she went to the phone, apparently called long distance to her parents or somebody that she was on the way. But I don't have any money for food. And there were two Catholic sisters on the bus. And I talked to them, you know, what should we help her? And we didn't feel we should, because she was using it on herself instead of the baby. And I haven't forgotten it. We didn't help her. We didn't talk. But when we went in to eat, she sat outside, and then somebody brought her a hamburger or something and gave her food. And I thought, we maybe should have done that too. But I thought she was herself was most important than that tiny baby that was with her. And I haven't forgotten that story. Today, I probably would have more nerve and talk to her and say, can I help you, but I don't want to, if you're going to smoke it, I'm not going to help you buy food. But we said nothing. Mm-hmm. That story, that experience just stuck with me.
Yeah.
I was not ministering to her, not helping her. Mm-hmm. And yet, I might have helped her the wrong way. Mm-hmm. She was just going to spend it on something.
What do you think? Oh, please.
This is a little different, but I was walking on the streets in Seattle, and as you all know, the homeless sort of multiplied at the point where funds for certain programs were diminished. There was a man sitting on the sidewalk, and the passerby threw 50 cents into his cup. And I was right behind the man who put the money in, and the man said it was his coffee cup. He wasn't even asking for it. And he said, people don't look at me as if I am, they just want to get past as fast as they can and put something in. And there's no eye contact or no connection. Your story reminded me of that. Mm-hmm. There's risk in even in looking at a person. But the man on the sidewalk thought it was demeaning, really. Mm-hmm.
Take care of you. Get him. Somebody else.
Well, Elmer, this is a changing kind of flip back and forth, but the story about the Jewish therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was visiting with a non-Christian friend, and she said, I just see you Christians studying over and over, year after year, and she says, when are you ever going to get it? The story.
I like that story. Somebody else? Yes?
Two more quick things. I think too often we try to be a little judgmental. What is really the need of that person? A friend of mine one time dealing with a Catholic priest, and the priest wanted to make sure that after their big fundraiser, everyone got food instead of money.
Mm-hmm.
My friend said, maybe they need money more, and the priest said, they might buy alcohol. Maybe they need that more tonight than food. Whose value system is in there? Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned libertarian, I told Bobby that night, run, baby. You ain't worth coming after. Escape.
Anybody bothered by libertarians, or maybe not? Maybe we have a group of libertarians here. Well, it sounds like it's easy, and that there's no price involved, and just go and do it. It sounds like that. I'm not saying the gospel is, but I think it's borderline that it's so weird from our sense of value that God would keep taking us back in there, or that we could be saints and sinners at the same time. We'd be screwing up our lives like mad and still be God's people, and on the other hand, be God's people and maybe want to be messing up or whatever it is. And when it comes to us, it sounds like maybe God doesn't even care about it, but God does. This story makes that quite clear, that it is God's invasion of humanity and presence with us in all forms and places and things. that God cares and wants. But sometimes we, as you were saying, we have to shift what values we're using in order to do some crazy stuff. Well, Carol Hinderly. You know, I don't know how many people know Carol Hinderly anymore. The fellow who made Holden what it is. He was a crazy nut. He's a crazy nut. The Holden hilarity, sometimes it was, far-fetched and all that, but sometimes it was of God. It came out of Galatians anyway, didn't it? He studied Galatians inside and out when he was in prison, the Japanese. And when he came back, it was just weird. All kinds of amazing stuff. Can I tell a story, Jordan, about Carol? Well, I hope this is true, but who cares? Most stories are, yeah. Fritz Norstedt, too. He told a lot of great stories, and some of them were true. But who cares? Carol, when we had the dance, right. Gertrude, what was the name of it? What did we call that? The nightclub. We had a nightclub over
in the nightclub, right.
Yeah. And we had topless dancers. All male. Carol and I were two of those and had a great time and just fun. And then people actually danced afterwards on the floor. We had tables around and everything else. And some of the people here really went after him for dancing, for even creating that kind of an atmosphere.
Also, we went out in the daily paper that we published, a topless dancing here, and we're all going to send it home to our parish. So we have the topless review at home.
Right.
Take care of registration.
Right. And either then or another time, but the next morning, I remember Carol coming to matins in the morning, leading matins, with a clerical collar on and a Playboy sweatshirt. And explaining to those people that their God was his devil. That's pretty tough stuff. Only a weird guy like Carol could get away with it. And maybe he didn't, I don't know if he really got away with it, but he was a crazy guy. And yeah, he so believed in the freedom of the gospel because of what God had done to him, for sure, and had done to him no small part through Galatians, which he knew inside out, in Greek as well as in English, that he fought. He fought for the liberty of doing things that he believed were certainly not evil. And that if you start making good things evil, you can well turn out to be the enemy. Yeah?
Can you kind of go back?
Sure.
Here? Takes some time to process. And I guess I have a real question about this, with handing people cash versus basic needs. And I think the story of the girl and the story of the fellow wanting $10. Mm-hmm. As Christian, where are we at? Do we give them $10 for their need for the night, their marijuana, their alcohol, mm-hmm. or do we try to get them their basic needs? And, you know, our social programs have tended to give dollars rather than the basic needs. And it's a dilemma to me. Anytime you give cash out to these folks that need to get off their substance, but where are we at, I guess, as Christians?
I think we got a bunch of political scientists in the village that are probably going to talk to us about that. But my answer is, we are at the point of being constantly reminded that that's our problem. That deciding how to help somebody to be struggling with that, and that wanting to help because of the constant help we get and because of the people we are in our baptism, that is our struggle and it never stops. No one promised we're going to have an answer to it. Or maybe Jesus would have said, give them $10, you know? It could have been. But the struggle is what we are about. And the push of the gospel is that that the, is this permissible? That the struggle is the fun. That the struggle is the fun of being the people of God in this age and being not blinded to be able to see the things that aren't seen. The woman blinded by her tears and wiping the feet.
I think that raises the issue that startled me in the scripture when I was thinking about Matthew, which is we struggle what to do with an individual we encounter on the street or on the church, porch church we were talking last night, or wherever, but we also struggle with the community response, which is the policy kind of side that you're raising. You know, what is, you respond to the need to feed or to quench the thirst is both of those levels, right? It's what you and I do individually, but it's also what we do corporately as a society and what works and what doesn't work.
Sure.
And I see our struggle there is figuring out what's true and study and information and dialogue in the light of gospel. That, you know, my whole being is that this political thing over here is not a political thing. This is what we're doing as a collective community. And the notion that Jesus was speaking here of judging groups, you know, herds of sheep and herds of goats, not just, Jackie, what do you do on the street to someone, but what do we do, how do we respond together? And I think those are real central questions.
In the earlier session, tying into that, Carol Nolte pointed out, verse 32, all the nations will be gathered before him. Not individuals, but nations were gathered. Was this a statement to the nation as well as to an individual? Is the nation pretending to be good when it isn't good? Is that what's being faced here? Or is the nation, when it does do something good, to be celebrated? Is that what's said here too? Another aspect of that corporate response to what's going on. Yeah.
And I also think the work that God does in us and in the people who need our help is God's work, not my work. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, it's our work. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, I mean, this codependency, you know, you want to. The big buzzword right now is we're all codependent, so we really don't need to help anybody else.
Right. don't want to be codependent with you.
but I don't really know what the word codependent means anymore, but it's God at that point in time, and each event is different. There's no rule you can apply and say, well, now I've got it figured out, and I just apply this rule every time I come across somebody who needs my help. You know, the gospel tells me what to do. Well, not as a rule, each one is different, so what I do, if I help somebody with money or help somebody with food or help somebody with conversation, I need to hear the gospel that time. What is God calling me as a single player in a much larger dance of what's going on? Somebody may have talked to that person just 10 minutes before saying the same thing that I'm going to say, and maybe it'll get through. Or maybe, you know, I'll be the Nathan and say, you know, you're the one or whatever, or somebody else has done that, and I'm going to have somebody who comes along and, you know, as a Samaritan finds a wound or whatever. But it's not my work, it's God's work. And it'll be something crazy, like you say, you know. Mm-hmm. Why, God, do you want me to do that? You know, but if you hear that voice in you, you're going to know. Maybe you're not going to know, but you're going to do something in response to what you think God is telling you to do.
Chuck over there.
Oh, yeah, please.
I have a friend that classifies people into two groups. He said there's one group that try to make life complex and easy, and another group that make it simple but difficult. He said, in regard to giving, he says if it's easy, it's wrong. But he says if it's simple and difficult, it's the gospel.
I think we all find our ways to figure these things out, and often are in conflict about it. Yeah, the 2 people, 10 people, 2 congregations, church bodies, whoever else, get in disagreement about how to go about it, and that's okay. Through the conflict, often the will of God is done. Yes.
Well, I have another little twist to it.
Sure.
Which comes from what I'm doing right now. And I'm switching from regular teaching to library. But the short of it is that I've been learning storytelling. And I just found out, you know, the criteria, and some of you might already know this, of what makes a story authentic. And of course, the Jewish storytellers are highly respected. But one of the criteria for what makes a story authentic is there has to be at least two versions of the story. And it just excited me. And it just released me because I kept thinking, I shouldn't be doing this right now because I keep forgetting details. You know, I don't think I can copy these stories, I'll get mixed up. So when I went out and did my first story, of course I added a piece, and I thought, that sounded kind of good. You know, it didn't hurt things too much. So then I thought of the four Gospels and how exciting it is that God has infused in people the ability to express in so many different ways. You know, and then, you know, when someone says, is the Gospel true? Well, I saw that in this version, you know, whatever. And, of course, it's authentic because there are at least two versions. And then I realized how God certainly allows us all this creativity to make these mistakes, that we don't have to do it right. We just do it.
Amen. I sure believe it. And then, you know, at least when I grew up, people were so worried about getting something wrong or something like that.
That's kind of
just tell the story. Tell the story. Tell the story, and let it be what it's going to be. The gift of the. And then some people with the kind of higher critical studies that are made of scriptures today, you know, we analyze all this, and that can be abused, of course. But what it usually does is pop up new kinds of stuff, and all of a sudden you think about it. Larry Rasmussen and Nava were over in Palestine, and the exciting thing was to get into some of the archaeological digs because it gave new flavor and a new look. And something you hadn't thought of in your life. I can think of Larry Rasmussen not having thought of anything already, but marvelous, you know, and fresh. And the same with the Fritz Norstedt stories, or A.R. Kretzmann and my history, told all kinds of stories about things that I had been at that I didn't recognize when he told them again, because he had his own story, and it was marvelous. But the pushes of letting the gospel be as exciting and startling and bothersome, you know? It isn't just to make us content and relaxed. We're supposed to be stirred up. I was stirred up last night, and I'm grateful for that stirring, for sure. Somebody else. Yes?
One of the things you mentioned early on, talking about becoming children of God, and I think of a sense the awesomeness of children with learning new things, and the sense that as they, part of their job as children is to just explore and to learn the world, and so around every corner for children is that startle, and I think that sometimes as we struggle with these issues, that the answer may be found in that sense of childhood that we've often lost in our heads, and the inability then of getting re-in touch with that, with the world as an emotional place. There's no answers. There's just what's around the next corner. I think that sometimes the gospel calls us. It's a cumulative thing, at least for me, is that as I have those experiences and I struggle with the guilt of not giving something to this person that seems to be in need, but continuing to use that as an internal fodder, essentially, for that, for going around the next corner.
When I don't do much preaching anymore, but when I do, and if I do a children's sermon, I start by asking the kids if they know how grown-ups learn. And, you know, they usually don't know what that question's all about. And I say, they learn by reading children's storybooks. and because often it's simple and true and startling, and so again, unless you become as little children, and I think that's what's behind that, is that waiting for the next corner. That's great. Yeah. Oh, I thought you had a hand.
Up here?
Yes, please.
Suddenly it is popping through my head that perhaps there's a twist to this story. We talk about the least of these as being opportunities for us to do God's work. And yet I can't help but wonder if truly that God's work is being done through these people for us. Mm-hmm. And not that we have something to do with them.
I believe that. Visits I've done to Guatemala and El Salvador and the rest, I did hardly anything for them when I was there, except to come back and tell stories. But what they did for me, I hope I'm eternally grateful for what they did for me. Yeah. Jin and I drove, my first wife and I drove 26 miles one way to attend worship in a black parish in Chicago. Tough, tough neighborhood. And because of what they did for us. They taught us so much about celebration and, you know, in the midst of it all. I went there because I thought I could help out, you know. And to this day, those marks are on me. And that's the way I feel about Holden Village, too. Come here to, you know, be on teaching staff, you know, and help out. It's a place where you get your nourishment. That's where it bounces back at you, for sure. That's a good point of the story. I appreciate you bring that in. Yeah. And that's the thing, when we worry about, well, if we do the right thing or not the right thing, we do this or that, don't worry about it, you know. You're probably getting something you don't understand anyway, so grab it, you know, take it, and don't get lost in the other.
Don't you think that sometimes we don't need to judge? I have a friend who works in a pantry. It's a Lutheran social service store in the San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. And she said 90% of the people that came in are conning them, and they know it. But they stay open for the 10% who really need it. So they treat everybody the same, and they know that some of these register at 3-4 different and go out with big bags of groceries from every store, but they stay open for the 10% who need it. So we don't judge, do we? We just, you know, if we see somebody that needs it, we don't decide whether or not they do need it. I don't know.
And the same may be true of nations. Same may be true of political parties. Since I actually met Newt Gingrich, and so you know, the differences and commitment about a way to go doesn't mean you have to be namby-pamby. The same with I'm delighted to be a Lutheran. I really am, but I surely don't believe Lutheran's the only way to understand life or God or Jesus Christ. Of course not. How odd of God to do that. But I'm glad to be what I am and let you know what I am. Glad as much as I can let you know. And maybe even some understanding of why I let you know. But anyway, I'm glad to be that. And then receive from the rest of what is being offered. God's got all kinds of ways to let that be known. And marvelous, marvelous. Exciting, startling ways. I don't know if the opposite of startling is stop.